Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn about ourselves and our society in a visit to the neighborhood Starbucks? Although the ubiquitous coffee retailer's earnings have fallen from their all-time highs, their products are still regularly consumed by millions of caffeine-loving Americans, and Starbucks stores aim to offer their customers a comfortably predictable third place outside of home and work. But while consumers may enjoy a little jolt of affordable luxury along with the buzz of sugar and caffeine, my guest today has discovered they are unlikely to have experienced any interaction with people they didn't already know, let alone an exchange of ideas. Bryant Simon is professor of history and director of American Studies at Temple University. For several years, he researched the history, business practices, and consumer experiences of Starbucks and visited well over 400 stores. His new book about what he learned is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Bryant, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Your writing in this book centers mostly on what you call the Starbucks moment, although in fact that moment was like 15 years.
Yeah. From about 1990 to 2005, Starbucks grew to sort of meteoric proportions. By 2005, it was opening a new store every 4 hours somewhere around the world and got about 45 million visits a week and employed somewhere in the neighborhood of 150,000 workers.
So it was a huge and remains a huge force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a force to be reckoned with in the business world and the real estate world. But what I was interested in was the cultural realm, and it there, too. It's a huge force to be reckoned with, not only has it taught us to appreciate a really fundamental commodity like coffee in a different way, it's taught us new languages, new ways to interact with space, and in some ways reflects new ways that we express ourselves politically.
Talk for a minute about what Americans seem to like about Starbucks.
Well, what they like about it, or what Starbucks has done, I think, is to create a product that matches many of our desires and then fulfill some of them and others not so well. But we just start with some of them. One is, you think about what coffee was like 20 years ago. It was pretty bad. And so, for starters, Starbucks elevated the category of coffee. Secondly, what Starbucks gave people was, and you said it in your intro, a predictable, clean, safe place to go. And as libraries closed and other institutions in America closed, there wasn't much of an alternative. And lastly, I think what people really liked about Starbucks is it gave them an affordable, everyday status symbol. And when Starbucks was at the height of its sort of powers, somebody could walk down the street, carry a cup of Starbucks, and other people would look at that person and say, oh, they're sophisticated, they're discerning, they have enough money to waste $4 on a cup of coffee, so they must be successful. And what happened is, once it had that aura, that sheen to it, the emulators came. People who wanted might not be so successful, might not be so discerning, might not be so sophisticated, bought the products, used them as advertisements of who they wanted to be. And that's good business if you can sort of get all that happening around a cup of coffee.
If we should back up here a bit and discuss the history of Starbucks, because
sure.
When this company began, it was very much about whole beans and a very purist attitude toward what coffee ought to be.
Yeah, it was. It came out of the 1960s in many ways and was a kind of form of countercultural capitalism, a way to take the values of the counterculture, of naturalness, of authenticity, and maybe make a little bit of money on them, but also to share ideas. And so it started in Seattle in 1971, and it kind of went along for a good long while as really just a place to buy beans. And the owners of it, the original owners of it, were really insistent on educating people about whole bean coffee. And so in those days, they didn't even sell drinks. They gave the drinks away to introduce people to the coffees that they had in the store.
And as they started to expand, one of the things that they always understood was that location was going to be critical.
Yeah, they were really smart about location. And, you know, the decisive moment here is when Howard Schultz comes into the company, who's now the chairman and CEO of the company. And the original founders of Starbucks were pretty set on creating a viable business model that sort of hovered on the edges of the mainstream. But Schultz wanted to really bring the company into the mainstream. And what he did was he bought real estate. But we'll go back to a point I made earlier. He also bought real estate that put Starbucks right in the way of what he understood as cultural leaders, as the kinds of people others would emulate. So I write in the book that at one point it was hard if you had an Ivy League education and a six-figure salary to miss the Starbucks. They put it in the places where those people others wanted to be like would adopt it, and then the emulators followed. So it was this sort of real estate but cultural model sort of fixed together. And now, I mean, you know, when we get sort of move forward, this real estate becomes a really important part of Starbucks' staying power. I mean, they've been as much a coffee company in some ways as a real estate company.
Talk about how that focus shifted from selling beans to selling coffee by the cup, because at this point, buying beans at the store is a really rare experience for people.
Though they are important showpieces. I mean, Starbucks uses them to sort of remind you that they the first thing you always see when you walk in are the beans, and that is to sort of set up that kind of idea that they're an important coffee company. But what happens is they slowly begin to offer drinks, and then Howard Schultz comes into the company. And he talks about having an epiphany going to Milan at one point and wants to introduce an espresso bar to America. And he can't talk the original Starbucks owners into it. At this point, he's not one of the owners. He's one of the marketing people for the company. And they're not sure they want to get into the drink business. They really kind of certain they don't want to be in what they call the restaurant business. And Schultz actually leaves the company for a while, opens his own set of espresso bars in Seattle, and then the owners of the original company buy Pete's, and they can't handle both companies at the same time. They don't have enough capital and enough time, and they put Starbucks up for sale, and Starbucks buys it. And he immediately pushes for growth, but also pushes for drinks, and, you know, drinks that you can buy and drinks that you can take away. The other thing that he pushes for really immediately is, again, trying to reach out into this broad mainstream, that he's going to turn on Americans to espresso-based drinks. But that also means the beginning of some compromises. Early on, Starbucks wouldn't, for instance, they wouldn't serve, and they didn't serve low-fat milk. But customers demand it, though coffee people think it's not the best thing. Schultz will let them have low-fat milk. And increasingly, what Starbucks will sell as it moves into the mainstream is a kind of watered-down version of coffee, often coffee kind of laden with milk and sugar, culminating in something like the Frappuccino.
Yeah, as you say, Starbucks figured out how to sell coffee to people who didn't actually like coffee.
Yeah. No, I think that was really important. I mean, coffee 20 years ago was a kind of drink associated with older people. The people kind of crouched over the counter at the diner or in the corner in the McDonald's. And young people didn't drink coffee. I don't know anyone. I'm 46. I don't know anyone who drank coffee when I was in high school. And what Starbucks did was, by changing the profile of coffee, of iced coffee drinks, of Frappuccinos, it reached out to a broader audience, but also it extended the coffee day. Cafes and places like that would close at 3 o'clock, but Starbucks had this expensive real estate, and they needed to sort of make money all day. And so what happened is some of the drinks became almost adult milkshakes that would be drank, later in the day or at night. And what that did, again, is twofold. It extended the coffee day, but also extended the audience for coffee. And by creating, and particularly one of the interesting dynamics that happened here, was to get teens on board. Teens are really an important part of Starbucks' customer base, and they're some of the most loyal patrons of Starbucks. But rarely do they drink straight coffee or even lattes. So they were some of the early adapters of these kind of really milky and sugary drinks. And then, as I say in the book, they would talk about how as they got older, they would graduate to lattes or to regular coffee.
Yeah, it was interesting. A couple of the teenagers that you interviewed in the book talked to you about how they felt grown up holding a Starbucks cup.
Yeah, I mean, in this sense, Starbucks was a really interesting place because, I mean, a couple of things were going on here that I think are fascinating, and I'm sure this happens in the kind of metro area, Dallas, is that teens don't have a lot of places to go. Parents actually trust Starbucks and let their kids go there. Inside Starbucks, there sort of has this grown-up aura with grown-up music and grown-up prices and grown-up drinks, but it's kind of unregulated. So teens can kind of do what they want. They could take a couch in the back. And so it was this perfect balance between sort of seeming safe enough but not regulated. They didn't have to deal with a wait person. So teens quickly adopted. From Starbucks' perspective, this is a really good thing because, again, that time period between 3 and 6 is kind of a dead zone for coffee places. So now they were able to create a clientele that kept the stores crowded during that downtime of 3 to 6, and the crowds actually act as sort of spurs for other people to buy things. We all know this without thinking about it. We're more likely to go into a store that has a crowd in it. It confers a certain popularity on that place and, you know, says, okay, well, we can go there. It's probably pretty good. This allowed Starbucks to stay crowded for takeaway customers, which is a really important part of how the business works. The people in the stores are almost props for the takeaway customers to let them know they're in a popular place, a crowded place, and a vibrant place. And then they say to themselves, well, maybe I'll go some other time when I have time.
Let's talk about the props aspect and the way these stores are decked out. You mentioned earlier that the whole beans that are sold at Starbucks serve as a sort of showpiece, as do, I guess, the $1,100 cappuccino machines that, in your experience with 15 hours a week in Starbucks for years, you never saw anybody buy.
Well, yeah, I mean, we live in them. People have talked about this. We live in increasingly an experience economy where you almost can imagine stores as set designs. And Starbucks is designed, I mean, really clearly as a kind of set to feature the brand and feature the things that it offers. And when you walk through the store, if you just kind of, you know, if we can picture it for a moment, almost the first thing you'll encounter when you walk in a store is a wicker basket filled with whole bean coffee. And just that little thing right there is saying, well, wicker and natural colors suggest natural products. The beans themselves suggest the naturalness of the product, the idea that they're better, kind of closer to nature. And then if we move along, I mean, you have the sound. I mean, Starbucks clearly created a soundscape for the stores. Jazz in the morning, music that Americans often associate with sophistication, kind of urbanity, and cool, right? The art on the walls was meant to sort of replicate some of those same values and also reference the coffee shop itself. The chairs, the fabric, often natural fabric on some chairs, other chairs would be velour and purple, which would suggest a kind of luxury and ornateness. And the machines themselves, at one point Starbucks introduced these really expensive machines, and again, I never saw anyone buy one of them. But what they did say, and they could have chosen a Mr. Coffee machine, but they didn't, was that this was a company that understood the technology involved in coffee, but also understood high-end products, and itself was a high-end product.
And then, of course, there is that lingo, not quite inscrutable, but you have to sort of get it to belong there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the lingo itself was a really important part of what Starbucks did. At first, it was an attempt to link Starbucks to Europe. The idea that many Americans had that the center of real and authentic coffee was in Europe. So that's the Italian kind of nature of it. And we have our own kind of, you know, love of Europe in this country and all this deference to it. But then the drink orders themselves became a way of creating a kind of belonging. And linguists talk about this all the time. Groups have in-group language, and Starbucks created its own language to show who was part of the group and who wasn't. And, I mean, my favorite story is I watched somebody walk into a Starbucks one time, and he came up to one of the workers, baristas, again, a kind of language.
Let me have you pause right there because we have to take a break, and we want to get the story, so we'll make it a little cliffhanger. Bryant Simon is my guest. He's professor of history and director of American Studies at Temple University. His new book is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of History and Director of American Studies at Temple University, Bryant Simon. His new book is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So, Bryant, before the break, we were talking about this in-group language that Starbucks created, and you had a favorite story about that.
Yeah, I was once at a Starbucks here in Philadelphia, and a guy comes in, and he talks to one of the baristas, and he's practicing his order. And he says, do I have it right? And he goes up to the counter, gets it wrong, and has to come back and practice it again. And, you know, I don't know if that was about the drink. It was about the order itself. And what's interesting is also how that the language of Starbucks is seeped into other places. As part of my research, I would often go to independent coffee places, and people spoke Starbucks there as well.
So in other words, they'd order a venti skinny latte.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Talk for a minute about your method of research. You spent a lot of time in coffee shops.
I did. And what I essentially did was I for about a year and a half, 2 years, I would spend 12 to 15 hours a week at Starbucks. And I would vary the stores by location, region, suburban, urban, and also I would vary where I sat in the store. Sometimes I would sit in the cafes. Sometimes I would sit and eavesdrop right next to where people picked up the drinks. I would also try and go at all different times of the day. I would go at night. I would go in the afternoon. I would go in the morning, just so I would get or try to get a complete picture of what people were doing, saying, and how and who they were talking to at Starbucks. And the other thing I would do is I would invite people with a particular expertise to go with me. So I might, for instance, I went with a lot of teens, and I would ask them what they saw, what they did. I also went with colorologists, interior designers, experienced architects, linguists, anyone who I thought could offer me some new or novel insight into how Starbucks worked and how people interacted with the brand.
Did you think at the outset that you were about to study the sort of American version of the 18th century British coffee house, this sort of de facto public square where great ideas were discussed and people sort of met up with their neighbors that they didn't already know?
I did. I mean, that's what I wanted to find out. I wanted to find out if in more suburban, less tightly knit America, Starbucks had become our version of either the 18th century British coffee shop or even, you know, a kind of version of the Cheers show where everyone knew your name. And that was really the fundamental question I started out with, and some of the other things sort of flowed out from it. But yeah, that was what I was most interested in this idea of how we were dealing with what I felt like was a kind of social isolation that existed in America.
But in fact, what you found was that isolation in some ways is reinforced.
I did. I didn't know if I would find this, but as I watched and I sat in Starbucks over the years, I found very few people who didn't talk to people they already knew. What I found people using the stores for was as a kind of respite, as a kind of in-between place between work and home. But that's not fundamentally what third spaces are about or what the British coffee shop of the 17th century about. They were about talk, and they were about creating a kind of free-flowing conversation that allowed people to do two things. One was to link up with people they didn't usually encounter in their daily lives, and secondly, to kind of further the project of democracy, to talk about issues in serious ways that would help the community solve the problems that were in front of them.
So the fact that people go there and sort of make coffee dates for either business purposes or for pleasure sort of negates that because they go there with a purpose and with an intended companion.
It doesn't necessarily negate it, but it seems it doesn't add to it. Mm-hmm. They seem to be in their own little bubble, their own little meeting bubble, and that's as much about the way in which we've transformed office space in America, the way in which you know people consult and telecommute, and they don't have sort of normal kind of access places. But that's not the basis of community. In some ways, you know, I talked about how Starbucks has become like a new second space. It's another workplace for us.
All that free Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a new thing at Starbucks. At first, they charged. That was one of the early ways the independents sort of started to cut into Starbucks business. Starbucks signed a long-term deal with T-Mobile, and they were charging when other people were offering for free.
Bryant,
they only gave it away for free after the Great Recession hit.
Bryant Simon is my guest. His new book is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Nadal in Plano. Hi, Nadal.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
All right, I had a question for Mr. Simons. I read over the summer that in Chicago they're going to be opening an adult Starbucks that's going to be serving alcoholic beverages. And I wanted to know, it was supposed to be rooted in the history of the company, and I wanted to know where exactly that history was. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. Have you heard about that?
I actually hadn't heard about that in Chicago. And I don't know of a time when Starbucks served alcoholic beverages. They are opening stores in Seattle. It's very interesting. They're opening stores in Seattle where they might serve alcohol, but don't have a Starbucks sign on them. So they're opening Starbucks stores that are not called Starbucks. They're named after the street that they're on.
It is pretty remarkable. I've been down near the Pike Street Market in Seattle where the first Starbucks location is, and it looks really different from the stores that we now associate with Starbucks.
Yeah, it does. And what's also interesting about that, how it's become a tourist site, that tour buses stop and people get out and flash their pictures at it. But that store was one of the first stores, if not the first store. And it reflects the kind of whole bean quality of it. It's a really simple square with rectangle with wood tables and room for the bins on either side. And it does speak to when Starbucks was essentially about the coffee, not when it became a kind of everyday space for lounging, for meeting, and for creating a kind of experience of luxury. That wasn't what it was about.
In defense of Starbucks, is it any company's responsibility to sort of foster public discourse, or is it their job to serve their shareholders and their customers?
Absolutely not. It's not their responsibility to foster public discourse, but Starbucks promises to do so. Part of its value proposition, part of the way in which it can justify charging $4 for a cup of coffee, is that it promotes itself as a third space. It creates an expectation on the part of customers that that's the place they can go to get conversation. And they use quotes of the coffee house all the time because they know the idea of the coffee house has value to us. So that's where the rub comes, right, is the disconnect between the promise and what's actually delivered that I think we can be critical of, not that they should have that mission inherently.
Another sort of implied promise at Starbucks is that the stores are pretty environmentally friendly. Can you talk about what you discovered to that end?
What Starbucks has actually a really commendable record in many ways on the environmental front. They bought a lot of renewable energy. They have introduced a lot of post-consumer use fiber to the products. In other words, recycled fiber products go into the paper. But what's interesting is that Starbucks, I mean, on each cup, it promises to save the planet. I mean, literally, it says that. Yet every time we get a paper cup, we're taking something away from the environment. And as long as Starbucks really pushes paper cups, which in some ways are its best form of advertising, right? Someone walking down the street carrying a Starbucks paper cup, its environmental imprint is actually probably weightier than the things it saves through its other actions. And so here's a kind of expectation we get to help the environment, but what we're really doing is satisfying our own wishes through takeaway consumption. And if Starbucks really wants to help us help the environment, it has to really attack the principle of takeaway consumption. And I think it could do so relatively easily. It could really push, as much as it pushed Paul McCartney CDs, the need and necessity of bringing your own takeaway container. It could ask you every time you want a cup of coffee, like the store down the street from where I live asks, for here to go. And if you say for here, you get a reusable cup. And there's no doubt that the water it takes to wash the cup is less than it takes to make more new paper cups. And the other thing about Starbucks, I mean, it's sort of interesting, is they were one of the early people to create cups with post-consumer use fiber in it, but the cups themselves cannot be recycled.
Because they're coated in plastic on the inside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Paul McCartney CDs. Talk for a minute about the music business and how Starbucks sort of packages itself as a service to introduce people to new artists.
Starbucks understood very early on that music was part of the cafe experience, and they began to create a kind of musicscape that would go with the cafe experience. And as they did, for instance, early on, they reintroduced a lot of people to blues and jazz in America. But what also happened was that people started asking for the CDs, and this was at the very moment that Tower Records and other companies were really having trouble. And Starbucks began to imagine itself not just as a place playing new and innovative music, but as a seller of music. And as it imagined itself as a seller of music, it started pushing the records that it wanted to sell, which usually weren't very interesting. And so this interesting flip happened. The interesting music became like a loss leader to sell the less interesting music. So you might have a World Beat CD there, and that was to say Starbucks knew a lot about music, but what they really wanted to sell was Paul McCartney.
Hmm.
And then what you have happening is an interesting, in the 1990s, Bruce Springsteen releases a record called Devils and Dust, and it has a graphic sexual reference in it. And Starbucks bans the record from the store. And, you know, that was no big deal for Springsteen. But the question, and people have talked about this, is how did other artists respond to that? Knowing that Starbucks was increasingly the place where you could sell music, were they tailoring their music to meet the soundscape of Starbucks? And some of the music people I talked to told me that there's no doubt that bands were doing that. Well, that becomes an interesting form of, you know, shaping the larger artistic world that we live in, maybe not for the best.
We should say that you have found a lot of parallels between the audience for Starbucks and the audience for NPR.
I mean, I do talk about this. One of the things that...
That has not escaped us around here either.
One of the things, you know, why people listen to your show is to discover something new and to do it, you know, relatively easily, right? That they can do that. And NPR has a kind of vibe to it of kind of for everyday discoverers. And Starbucks markets itself in a similar way to generally college-educated, generally well-informed people who want the sense of discovery because that gives them value. At a dinner party, they can say, oh, did you hear this, or do you know this? And but they don't want to do too much to get it. And so I think there is a parallel between how we consume information and knowledge and get it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bonnie in Sunnyvale. Hey, Bonnie.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
First of all, before I make my comment, I want to let you know that I did write an ode to Starbucks when I got our first little Starbucks in my little hometown in California, so I love Starbucks. However, I've got something to kind of comment about the second space that you were speaking of, and I agree with that. To the point where I no longer kick back and sit in a Starbucks any longer. I see so many people conducting business, and it's, you know, not something I want to do at that moment, sit next to somebody going over an interview. That one is almost, you know, the tension is too much for me on that one. Or sit next to somebody who's, you know, hashing out last month's numbers. It's just, it really kind of defeats, in my mind, the purpose of going in and sitting down. And it's changed so much over the last 10 years, and it almost feels passe to me. So I kind of agree with that second space thing, and I would really like to see or hear from your guest, how does that speak to America as far as how we tend to kind of commercialize stuff and actually turn it into something that's yesterday's news, really?
Thanks so much for your call. We'd love to hear from California.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the ode part is really great, and this is, I mean, I found this again and again in sort of the 1990s and early part of this century. Whole towns would petition Starbucks to locate there, almost like cities did in the 19th century trying to get a factory, which put them on the map. And now it's interesting, towns are fighting to keep Starbucks out. They feel like this branded world might make them too much like the next town down the street. So right there is an interesting transformation. And your caller also talked about how, you know, it just doesn't seem the same anymore. And I think this is the problem that Starbucks is in. They're both a victim of their success and a victim of kind of overgrowing. And what happens now is increasingly people, I don't think, see someone walking down the street with a cup of Starbucks in their hand, or at least my research has shown this, as someone who's cool and sophisticated and discerning. They see someone who might be a conformist or someone who just went for the easiest cup of coffee. That cultural shift is a real blow to the company. Now, within the stores themselves, here again, I mean, they were quite successful in luring people into the stores to offer them a kind of personal space. But I know sometimes I go into a Starbucks with my kids who are 8 and 10, and it's so quiet in there with everybody working that I feel like we're going to disrupt the proceedings, and I maybe we'll go someplace else. And so I think you reach a certain tipping point often, to borrow that term, where what you did successfully might alienate another part of your business.
Well, Bonnie's point also brings up something that you write about a lot in the book, which is the idea of self-gifting. You sort of give yourself a little treat by going to Starbucks, and part of your $4 or $5 for coffee means that you rent yourself a little spot where you get to do whatever you want for 20 minutes.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that sort of has remained kind of constant about Starbucks is actually the inflated price, the inflated language, and the inflated size of the drinks are good business for them, because they suggest that a treat. They suggest that you deserve something special in your life. And a lot of people use Starbucks as a kind of everyday form of what I call self-gifting and even retail therapy. And as part of that gift, we live in a really go-go world where time is something that is really a precious commodity. And Starbucks offers a kind of, for some people, a place to let down, relax, and be by themselves for a few minutes. I mean, I know that actually my wife uses it that way. I mean, sometimes she wants to get out, and it's time that matters to her, not necessarily the drink, but that's a gift if she's under a certain kind of stress. And this is a part of, I think, the Starbucks proposition that is holding pretty tight. I mean, I don't necessarily see people renegotiating that idea.
Bryant Simon is with us. He's professor of history and director of American Studies at Temple University. His new book is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bryant Simon. His new book is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Our next caller is Wayne, barreling down I-20. I hope you are driving safely, Wayne.
Yes, I am. Thanks
good.
For taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Apologies if I don't get good reception. I had a quick story, and then I wanted to ask a question around the franchising aspect or lack of that for Starbucks. Early in the early 90s, well, my family and I went to Seattle, visited some friends up there, and all weekend long had this glorious coffee. It was just wonderful, and I talked about how great it was. And at the end of our trip, before we were to head to the airport, we had about an hour before, and so our host said, well, let me make a pot of coffee before we go to the airport. And I said, no, I want to sleep on the plane. I don't like the decaf. It's just not as good. And her response was, that's interesting, because that's all I've been serving you all weekend is decaf. And so immediately I realized that, the quality was obviously superior. So when I got back to Dallas, I called the corporate headquarters and said, would you be interested in franchising? I told the story and said, it's great coffee, and I'd like to. And this was before there was a store on every corner. And their response was, no, not going to do that. Franchising is not a part of our future. And to my knowledge, they've not ever done that. I wanted to ask your guest if he has heard anything about, you know, was that just purely a, was it a quality reason to make sure that they, you know, they kept the quality there, or really did it have to do more with just the profits and, you know, what they felt like they could make?
Thanks,
and
sir.
I'll take my call off, my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for your call, Wayne.
Starbucks, it's an interesting point. Starbucks decided pretty early on not to go the McDonald's route, and that meant that they were not going to franchise, that they would open and own virtually every store. And the reason for that, I mean, essentially what they were trying to do was to maintain control, but it also meant they could open stores really close to each other. And so when you see two Starbucks stores close to each other, that's in part a product of the fact that Starbucks didn't franchise. They didn't have two franchisees having to worry about cutting the pie. So that's part of the reason why Starbucks went that route.
They
franchised a little bit now. Like when you see them on the freeways and when you see them in college campuses, sometimes franchise stores.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey. Great show as always. Just wanted to know what was the best story that the guest has ever heard when he's been to all of these Starbucks. And then I was going to say the thing I always hear when I'm in Starbucks, which I always love because I love the people watch and listen to them, is how horrible the economy is while they're drinking $5 lattes. I always think that's hilarious. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I guess I've seen a couple breakups in Starbucks. They're probably my best. I saw one in London and one actually in Fort Worth. So I've seen two breakups. And my favorite Starbucks story, though, is I was in Guadalajara, Mexico, and people valet parked to go to Starbucks.
Wow.
Which I thought was really kind of mind-boggling. The conversations, I mean, are interesting in the way, I mean, in some ways the most interesting conversations were the way that people would relate to the people who worked there. And sometimes people, I mean, this interesting thing of when people would go to Starbucks and they would find, I mean, I saw this happen a couple of times, and they would find a new barista, and they would challenge that barista to make their drink as if they knew more about the company than the barista did. And they really felt ownership over those drinks. In interesting ways, and some of the orders, I mean, it's always funny to kind of sit there and listen to some of the orders because they get so over the top.
What do you make of the fact, Bryant, that Starbucks is now pushing instant coffee and engaging in what, to my knowledge, is their first ever TV advertising campaign?
Well, I think that's evidence of Starbucks in some ways kind of grappling with its own weakened economic position. The TV ads in particular are interesting because for a long time, Starbucks used it as a badge of honor that it didn't advertise. And what it really was saying was to its customers, who themselves were suspicious of advertising, and they associated advertising with downmarket companies, that they were a different company, that they didn't need to use the sort of hokey kind of ads of a Budweiser or a McDonald's. And now you can see that they are increasingly forced to act like those more commodity-driven companies. And the instant coffee is an interesting story. I mean, clearly they started developing instant coffee long before the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and long before the collapse of the economy, and they spent a lot of money on it. And it actually tastes pretty good. I tasted it the other day. I mean, as instant coffee goes, I think it tastes, you know, way better than normal. But it seems like the wrong product at this time, to me at least. Right now, if I were Starbucks, I would really go back to emphasizing coffee. And no matter how good the instant coffee is, it takes away from the kind of more elevated coffee-ness of the company. I mean, we still associate instant coffee with something downmarket and bad. And I don't see how, again, no matter how good it is, it can really help them in dramatic ways.
Well, I think they've made some fascinating choices in the way they're advertising it, too, because in those commercials, the people that they're showing enjoying this instant coffee are not those that we generally assume to be particularly hip or well-heeled. They have nurses and Civil War reenactors and this cranky old white guy at a town hall meeting. These are not sort of classic Starbucks people.
But they're the people who drink instant coffee.
Huh.
I mean, instant coffee is a kind of lower-end product and probably skews older. And, I mean, it would be hard to imagine a teenager drinking instant coffee at this point. And they've been socialized into a different notion of coffee. And so I think they need to win them over to capture that part of the audience. The other ad, right, is that I've seen is on the stores is somebody with a roller bag, a business person, clearly, on the road. And the idea is you can have your Starbucks everywhere you go. You never can be. You have to be too far away from it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Misha in Dallas. Hey, Misha.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling to ask your guest about the Starbucks's parallel with the Walmart effect in small town America, and how what is Starbucks's approach or feeling? You know, they're supposed to be such a full-of-brand company, and yet they have put so many small businesses out of business.
This is one of Starbucks basher's favorite points. I'm not suggesting it, that your caller is a Starbucks basher. That Starbucks puts mom and pops out of business. I actually think the story is almost the opposite. I think that Starbucks put a lot of the mom and pops or small businesses in business. It created the market for specialty coffee. It created the taste for specialty coffee, and it created the language, and really it taught us how to spend $4 on a cup of coffee. What you see now is companies actually outperforming Starbucks, the independents. They offer a better product, a better story, maybe a greener product, and a more kind of socially engaged product. And part of what's happened in the Starbucks is these independents are pulling off some of its business. What Starbucks did do in affecting small companies is that it locked up the best locations in most cities. So if you wanted to get in the coffee game, you were stuck with a smaller market with less foot traffic. The other thing I think Starbucks did is it only hesitantly went into small towns, and only a little bit later did it kind of move into smaller towns in America. But most people in those small towns had tasted what Starbucks offered. And in many small places, you have faux or kind of, you know, facsimiles of Starbucks opening up, because Starbucks won't move into those places. And it again, has created this kind of market for coffee. Now, the other part of what it does in terms of takeaway from community, I think, is a more subtle point, is that as Starbucks has advanced across the landscape, it's made many places look the same. And people now complain about Starbucks and other brands creating kind of clone towns and a monoculture of sameness. And that, to me, is perhaps the biggest threat when it begins to assault our sense of place, the way independent geographies look. We all lose something. If you think about it for a second, think about how much art, how much rock and roll, how much country music is based on a sense of place. Well, if every place looks the same, what are we going to sing about?
You have a story in the book about, I guess a lot of Starbucks have these, there's a little community bulletin board in the back. And there's a huge list of what can't go on there, to the extent that nobody from the community actually posts anything.
Yeah, I mean, this is back to our question of the coffee house and community. Starbucks, the community board is something many of us associate with kind of independent places where we get information about the community we live in. And Starbucks, at least according to a somewhat dated now employee manual, said you could put anything you want up there, but it had to do with Starbucks. And if it didn't have to do with Starbucks, it shouldn't be up there. And I tell another story about going into a store in Austin, and the manager takes me over and shows me the board, and it's empty, and she says, that's just the way we like it. but in a sense, right, this speaks to the kind of facsimile of community that's being produced at Starbucks. If it lends itself to the brand, it's okay. But that's not really what community is about, and definitely you can't put anything about politics up, or even religion for that matter.
They have, Bryant, been lauded for providing health insurance for a lot more of their employees, including some part-timers, than many other companies with people at similar salary structures.
Can I just say, all Starbucks employees are part-timers except the managers.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Go ahead.
How well do they treat their employees?
Well, as someone lately sort of paraphrase, this is one of my informants said to me, it's a decent crap job. And I think that's probably about right. I mean, it's a decent job in that market. And one of the things that Starbucks had to do was make the job decent enough that they could compete for employees who didn't want to work at McDonald's. And one of the ways they did that was offer health care. And health care did two things for them. It put them, so this isn't really a gift in a sense. It put them with a group of employees who are often better educated, who could serve Starbucks better educated clientele. And secondly, it allowed them to reduce turnover rates. Because, I mean, and so one of the points I try and make throughout the book is the way what Starbucks does is a reflection and a refraction of what's going on in America. Well, Starbucks is able to use this as a way to keep a steady workforce because of a kind of larger healthcare crisis in America that 20-somethings just out of college and in between, you know, sort of starting their careers are particularly susceptible to. So Starbucks often portrays this providing of healthcare as a gift, but it's part of a kind of economic calculation and a rational and smart one on their part.
So what future do you see for Starbucks, the company, and then the relationship between middle-class Americans and this company that they've come, in many cases, to really like?
Well, it's interesting what Starbucks is doing now. I mean, there's sort of two-headed strategy that they're pursuing right now. On one level, there is trying to get back to the kind of cultural position that it used to have as the kind of place where, you know, discerning, sophisticated Americans get their coffee, and some of the advertising does that. But if you look at what Starbucks actually does, they're pursuing this kind of McDonald's strategy of cutting prices, of offering essentially value meals, of actually redisciplining workers so that they take fewer steps in producing the drinks and the products. So I don't know which one of those two strategies is going to win out. For my money, I think that Starbucks will end up sort of like the Gap, that you can buy a pair of khakis or a T-shirt at the Gap, and it doesn't elevate your status.
Are you with us, Bryant? Okay, we are having phone problems. Are you with us, Bryant? Okay, well, Bryant Simon was my guest. We were talking this hour about his new book. It is called Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Bryant Simon is professor of history and director of American Studies at Temple University. Again, that new book, Everything But the Coffee. Thanks very much for spending the hour with us, and we will thank Bryant from a distance. And thank you very much for listening. My name is Chris Boyd. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.